There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad that you could join me for some classic cardboard conversation. And when it comes to classics, does it get any more classic and down home, down to earth, and certainly affordable than minor league baseball? In my opinion, no, not at all. I love Major League Baseball. I love traveling to Major League Baseball games. You know, back in the day when you could actually travel to Major League Baseball games. But I enjoy, you know, seeing the big parks and seeing the big stars. And, you know, just sometimes it's the journey, not the destination. It's the road trips with family members or friends. Adding to that checklist of Major League cities and stadiums that you've been to, you know, you kind of brag about it to your friends. It's not quite like a sexual conquest list, but it's close, isn't it? Oh, I've been to this city, this city, this city. Oh, yeah? Well, I've been to this one. You've been to Wrigley? Tell me about it. It's not quite the same, but if you're a baseball fan, it's close. And even though you're always setting your dreams at major league levels, whether you're a player or a fan, there is just still nothing as attractive, as appealing, as simple in most cases as minor league baseball. And my love for minor league baseball goes way back into the mid-1980s when I very faintly recall attending a handful of Tampa Tarpons games here in Tampa, Florida, where I still live. And the Tampa Tarpons back in the, not just mid-80s, but really going back to the 1960s, were a longtime Florida State League affiliate, Advanced A for many years, of the Cincinnati Reds. When the Reds had their spring training at Al Lopez Field in Tampa, which used to stand where Raymond James Stadium currently does, the Reds would come in, they would do their spring training, they'd head back north to Cincinnati, and some of the up-and-coming prospects would be playing for the Tarpons. And the Tarpons, even though they were a minor league team, and even though Tampa Bay was still very much a minor league sports market, you know, you had the Buccaneers, but, you know, these were the god-awful creamsicle Lehman Bennett days of the Buccaneers. And you had the Rowdies of the North American Soccer League, but the NASL was kind of heading downhill at that time. You had Bandit Ball, you had the USFL going on at the time. But, you know, Tampa was just not as major league then, 35 years ago, as it is now. Home to a defending Stanley Cup champion, a pretty good baseball team in the Rays, pretty good NFL team in the Buccaneers now. Completely different time. And because the market was kind of minor league at the time, fans loved the minor league ball team. Yes, baseball fans still liked their hometown team from whatever city they had moved from. And fans growing up in Florida during the 1980s, during the cable superstations, certainly started making allegiances to the Cubs and the Braves and the Mets, thanks to cable television. But when you could just go right into the sleepy part of Tampa, just north of downtown, and pull into the gravel parking lot outside of Tampa Stadium where the Buccaneers played, walk into Al Lopez Field, just kind of this rusty old 1950s stadium, and for just a couple dollars, get in. For a couple dollars more, get a hot dog and a drink. And cheer on the home team. It was always fun. And even as a kid, and like I said, I faintly remember the games just because mostly my dad took me and my brothers out there just to get out of the house for a little bit. But also because Tampa Tarpons tickets, if you knew where to look, you could get them for free. They were typically stacked up by the cash register at your local Eckerd drug stores. So even though I don't recall many of the details of the games, I don't recall any of the players. And that partially says more about the Reds farm system in circa 1984-85. I still remember just the overall experience. And it was just something that was really fun to be part of as a youngster, to have, you know, dad and sometimes mom would come along, but, you know, have a parent and your siblings go out and enjoy a little baseball. And that was a cheap and easy way to kill a couple of hours on any random late spring or early summer night in Florida when it wasn't downpouring from the typical 4:30 thunderstorm. And for me, the minor league love continued when I really did start getting into baseball more, Major League Baseball. And again, growing up in the Tampa area was very influential for me because, you know, Tampa Bay is still a hot spot for spring training for many of these Major League teams. And still, many teams have their spring training operations and Florida State League operations in the area. So even though we have the option to go to Tropicana Field and take in a Tampa Bay Rays game, which we enjoy doing, still nothing beats getting a ticket for about $6, maybe $8, getting a cheap hot dog, getting a relatively cheap beer, watching some goofy on-field promotions, and watching a bunch of 19 and 20 and 21-year-old kids try to figure out this game at the next level, all for the sake of hopefully you get to see these guys in the big leagues in a few years. And you're still able to do that. We live not too far from where the Tampa Tarpons version 2.0 play. That has been the rechristened Tampa Yankees team, of course, a Yankees farm club. Yankee spring training across the street from Raymond James Stadium. And, you know, we've seen some Yankee prospects, or what is typically the situation, former Yankee prospects who were traded for veteran players. You get to see them at a young age, but also, you know, the visiting players. And I get a chuckle when I look at the Toronto Blue Jays lineup today and you see Vlad Guerrero Jr. and you see a Biggio in the lineup. You see a Bichette in the lineup. And we got to see Bichette, Biggio, and Guerrero 3 or 4 years ago in a minor league game as the visiting team. And I had a flashback, too. I was like, wait a minute. Is this, you know, 2016 or, you know, 1989? What's going on with these names? But it's interesting to see those players develop. And, you know, it's been a nice run for me as a minor league fan over the last, I'd say, about 35 years. And, you know, like I said, when I started really getting into Major League Baseball, when I was, you know, around 10 or 11 years old, going to the minor league games was still an absolute blast. And I remember going to Dunedin, watching the Dunedin Blue Jays and, you know, getting to see Carlos Delgado just slamming balls over the outfield fence night in and night out, and seeing some of the other up-and-coming prospects for teams coming through the area. It was really exciting. So you can imagine my excitement when, at around the same time, the perfect storm came together. And I mean a good storm, where I had this newfound fanatical love of sports and particularly baseball, a newfound fanatic love for baseball cards, and my newfound fanatic love for minor league baseball. Because again, in the day and age before the Tampa Bay Rays came around, that was our baseball option. That was it. But you had several to choose from. Like I said, you've got a few Florida State League teams in the area. So circa 1990, as I'm diving into baseball, diving into minor league baseball, diving into the baseball cards, you can imagine the thrill I had when I was at a local hobby shop looking at all the various boxes of cards, and I saw minor league baseball cards, pro cards, to be exact. And I remember buying two or three packs, not really knowing anybody in the packs, although judging by the special wood grain border treatment, I knew that the Frank Thomas and Moises Alou cards that I pulled from those packs must be special. And I still have them, by the way. But even though I didn't really know the players, even though I didn't really know the teams, I was introduced to teams that make 13-year-olds laugh, like the Portland Beavers. I mean, you know, you're 13 years old, you see beavers on somebody's jersey, you kind of laugh. And I fell in love with minor league baseball cards at that point in time. And while that was a good storm for me, it would be the tide before the bad storm for the hobby, much like pretty much everything else in the hobby around 1990, 91, 92. While things were peaking, things were also very much getting saturated. And as the chase for a rookie card grew throughout the 1980s, the chase for the pre-rookie card, if you will, went through the roof in the early 1990s, as what started as a fairly innocent project by our friends with the TCMA company back in the 1970s blossomed into another very, very lucrative branch, another very lucrative revenue stream for companies that were making minor league cards. And what started as pro cards in the late 80s and early 90s very quickly grew into everybody else trying to take advantage of the pre-rookie fanaticism in the form of a minor league baseball card. And that leads us to the set that we're going to be looking at this week, the 1991 Classic Best Minor League Cards. And I apologize, I know in previous shows I had said 1993. I actually meant 1991. Have you ever just bought a bunch of things online all at once and after the shopping spree is done, you kind of forgot what you bought? Well, that's what happened to me, you know, several weeks back when I bought a lot of the packs that we've been discussing on this program in recent episodes. I remember buying classic minor league cards, but completely forgetting what year they were from, 1991. But as you'll see, even though 1991 was the beginning of a tipping point for minor league baseball cards, for better or for worse, it is still a very fun time to look back at these cards because it was the first step forward for a lot of minor league cards going from regional tchotchke status to nationwide fame. But also, it is fun to look back at these cards because there are quite a few Hall of Fame players that you can find in these sets. Before they started out on their major league success, they had to play in the minor leagues. And I managed to even grab a couple of them in the three packs that I had. Slightly damaged, but that's okay. And I'll explain why later on. Now, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. Our next show is scheduled for Friday, October the 23rd, and we are scheduled to take a look at a couple of novelties from the hobby. The 1987 Donruss All-Star Pop-Ups, which are pretty neat. We got a few of those packs. And also the very unique attempt at Topps to continue to push forward its chewing gum line, of course made popular by the Bazooka Joe comics, But trying to rebrand it as Topps Chewing Gum in the late 1970s, they attempted to replace the Bazooka Joe comics with comics of all-star baseball players. And sadly, strangely, it didn't work. Only lasted 1 year in 1979. And we have a few stale pieces of bubblegum with those wrappers. We're going to open those up and take a look at the wrappers and what was good and what wasn't good about that. But just one of the many innovations that Topps was toying around with at that point in time, not only to help sell bubblegum, and that is something that they did in numerous ways at that time, but also to try to cut off the competition at the head. Yes, they were just months away from the U.S. Supreme Court determining that Topps had a monopoly and they had to open the door to competitors. So before Fleer and Donruss and then everybody else broke down those doors in the 1980s, Topps toying around with ideas to try to make themselves more relevant before the competition could take over. So we will take a look at both of those items. Again, Friday, October 23rd, we are scheduled to do that. Now, our last show, taking a look back at 1961, Topps, was met with a lot of fanfare and a lot of appreciation, a lot of kind thoughts, too. Really appreciate everybody who chimed in on 61 Topps. Of course, a lot of the conversation was based around the critiques or the love for 61 Topps. Some people will say it's kind of boring and plain. Others will say it's a work of art, kind of in the 53 Bowman or 57 Topps mantra. And I'm somebody who's going to play it right down the middle. It can be a little bit of both, and that's okay. And I love some of the comments that we got from our Twitter timeline here, Wax and Gum Stains, including from our good friend Suspicious Cat. I know why they had to be plain, but they didn't have to look so bad. They somehow managed to make even Banks, Mays, and Killebrew look bad. So a vote of non-confidence there from Suspicious Cat. At the other end of the spectrum here, we've got KSCGSF Podcast. I like it. It doesn't quite hang with the amazing designs that most of the 50s sets had, but still elegant in its simple presentation. Also, PK Steinberg noting, definitely a masterpiece. It's delicious. I wouldn't chew on them, though. That's, 60-year-old cardboard. Yeah, you definitely don't want to gnaw on that. Cully Scarborough says, my vote, classic. And we had some more thoughts, including a sharing of a slightly off-centered 61 Willie McCovey. Of course, we featured Stretch as one of our players there. Chris Pullman sharing a picture of his McCovey card from 61. Just finished listening to the latest episode. Loved it. Thanks for the retrospective on Stretch. Glad that we could do that, especially because in the great lore of many San Francisco / New York Giants players, McCovey often gets overlooked, and it's amazing that he does, considering the terror that he, you know, put on many National League pitchers throughout his career. Audiolux 7 also sending us a picture of a few cards from his 61 Topps collection. Says, in relation to your latest episode, figured I had to share my contribution. Was my first quarantine little card project this year. Showing off, let's see, who do we have here? The Killebrew, Jim Gentile. Also Mantle and Maris, plus your home run leaders from the 1960 season. Audiolux continues, the underrated 61 movie was also a source of inspiration, but I've always had love for the Topps set. And really appreciate all the thought there regarding the 61 Top show that we did recently. Now, you can always comment about our program at Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. So if you want to talk about the program, the sets we talk about, the players, or if you ever have any show suggestions, you're more than welcome to put them there. And also, if you have a few extra bucks available, you're more than welcome to send us a donation via paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Even small donations of $5, $6, $7, anything like that goes a long way. First, helping us maintain the program online. It keeps our home base at audioboom.com open. It keeps our archives free for everybody to listen and download if you wish. And it also helps us purchase the products that we discuss on this program. And don't forget any excess product that we have, especially if we buy several packs or perhaps a box of cards to discuss. Excess product we pass along to our good friends at Commons for Kids, who collect common sports and not so sports cards, non-sports, I guess you could say, but they collect the commons and also not so commons. So if you've got some star cards or rookie cards, pass them along, because Commons for Kids will deliver those cards to kids who just need something positive these days. And of course, we could all use something positive these days. But in particular, children who are often kind of left behind in the dust with all the news and noise that happens today. Kids who are dealing with medical issues, kids who are dealing with financial issues, maybe problems at homes. They need the assistance here. And what better way to assist them in finding some happiness, some joy in life, than by giving them some baseball cards, some cards of their favorite team or perhaps their favorite player. And you can make those donations to Commons for Kids as well. Follow them on Twitter, Commons for Kids. That's the number four. And make sure that you mix up the donations too, all right? Not just your junk wax era stuff here. Let's get some contemporary stuff, maybe some classic stuff from the 60s and 70s too. You got those dupes hanging around. Commons for Kids, definitely a good place to send them off to. Now, as for the topic of this week's show, that of course being minor league cards, we decided to start the week off with a poll on wax and gum stains, mentioning that we were talking 1991 classic minor league packs, but asking you, did you collect minor league cards when you were younger? So the options were yes, no, or younger, I still do. And I was not totally surprised by the outcome of the poll here. Now, granted, a small sample survey, but according to those who did answer, 51% said no. They don't collect minor league cards. I have a reason why they probably didn't. 41% said yes, and 8% went with younger. I still do. And I actually kind of fall in that line as well. I have no desire to buy minor league baseball cards, and I'll get into the details of that in just a little bit. Now, we also had some commentary about those minor league cards, including from Topps Pursuit, says, I didn't collect them as a kid, but when I got back into the hobby in 2019, I started seeking out Rochester Red Wings team sets for my collection. You know, I grew up in Rochester, and I probably went to a Red Wings game when I was very young, but I don't recall that because we were very young. I've actually got a fun Red Wings story to tell in a moment, but let me continue with Topps Pursuit's thoughts. It says, I'm now at 41 of the 53 commercially available sets that I've been able to track down through research. That is very cool. Now, not too far from Rochester, we've got Buffalo. Waxpack916 chiming in that he collects Buffalo Bisons team sets. I misplaced my original collection, but recently bought new ones. Brian Krause says, I bought a few sets, still excited that I have the Ricky Henderson set, though my Corey Snyder set didn't quite pan out. Well, you could say much of the same for Corey Snyder in general. And Brian Kilby adds, knowing nothing about minor league cards except that I paid a quarter for the pack I'm opening, I can't help but feel like I'm going to find a 1952 Mickey Mantle or something, like some unknown treasure is hidden within, ignoring the fact that I only paid 25 cents. And that is part of the allure of minor league baseball cards, as we'll get into when kind of looking over the brief history of the minor league cards before we dive into a little detail about the 91 classic set, as well as four players that we randomly pulled from the packs that we open. Now, let me quickly finish up the minor league baseball story with the Rochester Red Wings. Thanks a lot, Topps Pursuit. You reminded me of this. A little bit of a sidebar here. Even though I don't recall if I went to a game at the old Silver Stadium in Rochester, but I do know that my older brother Mike went there, and he would have been, let's see, 6 years old at the time. I believe this was 1980. I would have only been 2.5. So that's why I may have been there, but I clearly don't recall anything. But the story has been handed down. Silver Stadium was one of those old Depression-era minor league ballparks, and even in 1980, it wasn't quite modernized, as you had the old wood slat seats throughout the stadium. And the wood slats, people tend to forget, were held together by wrought iron steel frames. And my brother, who, again, was probably about 6 years old at the time, while doing what six-year-olds do, which is crawl all over the seats and basically do everything but watch the baseball game that you're there to watch, was crawling up and down the seats, and he sat down in a seat, and his hand had slipped down between where the slats from the seat bottom and the metal axle that brings the seat bottom down come together. So basically, he pinched his hand inside the metal frame of the wooden seat. Naturally, this did not feel good to him. He was in quite a bit of pain and crying. Thankfully, he didn't, you know, break a finger or, you know, have any kind of laceration or anything major like that. It's amazing. Little kids' hands have that capability. I think when I was a kid, I slammed my hand in a car door, yet amazingly didn't break anything. Somehow, even though we have very little hands and little digits, they're very pliable at a young age. And that was the same thing with my older brother. Of course, he was in pain, and they were able to get his hand unwedged from the seat pretty quickly. And of course, not wanting to see a six-year-old boy crying at a baseball game, the Rochester Red Wings management, or somebody on the field who saw this happen, was able to procure a team-signed baseball. And they gave that to my brother kind of as a, you know, hey, hope you're feeling better gift. And my brother, I think, still has that ball. And of course, as I was getting into minor league baseball and major league baseball and collectibles, naturally, I had to look the ball over just to make sure there wasn't some Hall of Fame player who had signed it. The 1980 Rochester Red Wings did not have one. I believe the most notable or recognizable name was Mike Boddicker, but we were about a year short of getting Cal Ripken Jr., unfortunately. The Red Wings, a longtime Orioles farm team, in fact, for about 30 years, I want to say. I want to say, you know, like late 60s to the mid to late 90s, and prior to that, a longtime farm club for the St. Louis Cardinals. But just a fun little story there. So Topps Pursuit, thanks again for sharing your Red Wings collection story. It allowed me to share the wonderful story of my older brother smashing his hand into a seat at Silver Stadium, but still getting a team-signed baseball out of all the pain and all of the effort. Now, as for minor league baseball cards, as I said earlier, this was something that was actually driven by TCMA back in the mid-1970s, and I can't exactly say that it was a huge moneymaker for them. It was kind of a loss leader, but certainly it was something that was able to show off what TCMA could do. They could either take pictures of players or take a collection of pictures of players, put together a very basic design, which is what TCMA liked to do. They didn't like the gaudy baseball cards that Topps was putting out in the 70s. And you could put together a small print run of these sets, say, I don't know, maybe 1,000 for a team, and you could give them away on baseball card night, or you can sell them in the team store. And I would say that this would be a loss leader, because while I'm sure that they made enough money back to cover the cost of assembling these cards, there was really not much value to these cards outside of the market that these cards were made. And all you have to do to figure out what the minor league baseball market was back in the mid-1970s is just take a look at baseballreference.com at some of the minor league towns that you had. You know, by the mid-1970s, most minor league towns, at least most long-term minor league towns like Pacific Coast League towns. They had already added Major League Baseball, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle was getting a team. There were two teams in Canada. A lot of places that were destinations for minor league baseball had become major league towns by that point in time. So when you look at the minor league baseball scene in the 1970s, you've got a lot of small town, mid-America kind of situations here, whether it be like Clinton, Iowa, or maybe it's Tucson, Arizona. And again, like I said, in the 80s, Tampa was still a small town. You could say the same thing for Orlando, even minor league teams that played near Miami, even though Miami was a big town. Outside of the Dolphins, you didn't have a whole lot of professional sports there. Florida was still very much a retirement community at that time. So you had, big towns that were kind of sleepy, or you had a lot of small towns. So once you made that run of, again, let's say 1,000 sets for the baseball team to sell, what would happen is they would give them away on baseball card night. They would try to sell them in the team store. And, let's say the 1975 season is over. You're moving on to 1976. Well, guess what? So is probably 80% of your roster. So these teams would very likely either just give these cards away to, employees, or they just throw them out. You'd mark them down as much as you could, but if you couldn't give them away, they just went right into the trash can. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, I should say, that would have been the standard operating procedure for probably a good 10 or so years. Now, as we get into the 1980s, and as there is still a market for minor league baseball cards, there's also starting to build up an appetite for rookie cards. And we talked about this in a podcast not that long ago, specifically looking at 83 Tops, but 1983 being, I wouldn't say the year, but certainly a benchmark where card collectors were going crazy for the rookie cards and the rookie class. And of course, you talk about Ryan Sandberg and Tony Gwynn and Wade Boggs, but you also have to look at young phenoms like Ron Kittle in 1983 or Joe Charbonneau a couple of years before. Of course, you had Cal Ripken Jr. in the midst of that. And, by 1983, there was just this fevered pitch for rookie cards. And that is when the card companies, started really branding some of their rookie cards, Tops digging up the old, rookie team trophy for some of their cards, also eventually creating the Future Stars kind of subset within the base set. Donruss with the rated rookies, Fleer would have the rookie star cards as part of their sets, and everybody starts going rookie crazy in the mid-1980s. Afterwards, Don Mattingly, the big chase card in 1984, Kirby Puckett, Roger Clemens, Darryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden, you name it. Anybody who had any sense of superstardom as a youngster, people went crazy trying to track down their rookie cards. So it is not a coincidence that in the mid-1980s, there starts a little bit of focus on minor league baseball cards. So what started as just a regional tchotchke giveaway, very basic thing, starts turning into a business. And of course, the minor league teams, which are always big on promotions, love baseball cards. It's one of the easiest promotions that you can pull in a decent crowd for. And in the end, again, doesn't really cost them that much. You buy 1,000 sets for a season. Let's say you're paying $2 a set. Again, mid-1980s here, things were a little cheaper back then. A $2,000 expense, you could sell these team sets for $5 a piece and make some money on the back end. Of course, you'd be making some money too on the baseball card night because you're anticipating maybe a few more people coming in through the gate. And that's additional ticket revenue here. So it's one of the easiest giveaways for minor league baseball teams. So, of course, they're invested in it as well. And we are looking at more minor league teams doing this. You're looking at the rookie card craze going on at the time. The hobby in general is just growing in the mid-80s. So you start getting these more elaborate designs and larger production of cards. And like I said, Pro Cards was one of the big minor league baseball card producers starting in the mid to late 1980s. So you not only have the rookie card push in Major League Baseball in the 80s, now everybody is starting to look back at some of the minor league cards of these players. So Cal Ripken Jr. with the Rochester Red Wings, suddenly there's a desire for that. You know, Daryl Strawberry with the Tidewater Tides, there's a sudden desire for that. And now collectors, they're not just satisfied with an 82 Topps Cal Ripken Jr. Now they've got to find that 81 TCMA Rochester Red Wings Cal Ripken Jr. card. So starting in the mid to late 80s, you've got collectors combing through, these minor league collections, reaching out to these small town collectors, trying to find that Mark McGwire or Jose Canseco card or Eric Davis card when they were in the minor leagues a few years prior. And because of the scarcity of these cards, remember, limited print runs, typically regional, you know, there were sets that were either manhandled by kids or thrown out over years. You had a limited supply of these cards, so that naturally drove the price up. So now all of a sudden, by the late 1980s, there is a very active and somewhat lucrative business in minor league baseball cards. Well, a good thing has to come to an end, right? So as you have these major production factors come in, and rather than having maybe 1,000 team sets done just for the local advanced A team in town, now you're having, you know, 1 million cards produced for national distribution. And sure, you have a 400 card series, and maybe the collectors only have heard of 3 or 4 of these guys. But in the hopes of landing, like one of our followers said, you know, that Mickey Mantle minor league version card, because you're chasing some of those future stars here, there was a lot of traffic going to minor league baseball cards by the early 1990s. And minor league baseball was also having a very successful run in the late 80s and early 90s for a couple of reasons. One, fans were starting to get turned off by a lot of things happening in Major League Baseball. Of course, you had these intermittent work stoppages throughout the 1980s. Player contracts started going up, so the quote-unquote average fan didn't really have that real-world connection to a lot of these players, certainly at least not connected to what they were making. But also you had the collusion going on. You had a whole lot of things going on in the 1980s that started retracting some fans. And then on top of that, you just have the economic situation going on. After a very, you know, boom economy in the mid to late 1980s, you know, the savings and loans crisis, the recession around 89, 90 starts kicking in here. And people don't want to invest in going to a major league ball game, and certainly not paying these millionaire stars. So why spend $25 on a ticket to, go see the Mets when you hop on a train or maybe take a little car ride, go down to South Jersey, and you're seeing the local team in, I don't know, Trenton play or something like that. You kind of catch the drift there. You know, instead of going to a Phillies game, let's go to Harrisburg. Yeah, you know, you can save some money, have a little bit of an adventure too, and see the stars of tomorrow today. So it's, again, a great just combination of things coming together here. And the people at Classic saw this coming, and they decided to jump on the bandwagon as well. Now, I was not a huge fan of the Classic cards that came out in the late 1980s for numerous reasons. One, you know, you couldn't look them up in the Beckett price guide. You know, they considered the Classic cards to kind of be one-offs and never valued them. So it was always hard to put a price tag on some of these cards. And also, you know, the Classic cards just seemed kind of, I don't know, seemed kind of schlocky. It's just the whole premise of Classic I just never bought into. But if you were a rookie card fiend, then you love the Classic Four Sport, which, you know, was featuring guys like Derek Jeter you know, playing high school baseball well before Derek Jeter started getting Major League Baseball cards produced. So, you know, to each his own, but I was never a big fan of Classic. But Classic still saw the opportunity in minor league baseball cards and decided that they needed to invest in it. Now, you have a set of 396 cards. Those would be the low numbers. You would also have 54 additional cards that would make a high number series that you could introduce a little later on in the season for those minor league players and maybe college athletes who sign on to a minor league team afterwards. You can showcase those at another time. But again, with minor league baseball cards, you're running the risk of how do we put together a set filled with players that might be good, but you're never really sure. And that was an interesting conundrum with Pro Cards, because Pro Cards had a AA and a AAA set. You're more than likely to find a star or two in a AAA set as opposed to AA, where, you know, probably 90% of the players at AA, they're either going to make it or break it at that level. So Classic realizes this, and they realize that they need to have a good balance of AAA and AA players. But rather than just producing 20 or 25 cards for each team at the level, they had to do their research and find the five or six best players with each team. But they also had to utilize some star power. Sure, you can tell everybody, hey, this player is going to be the next big thing, come buy our product. Or you can say, come buy our product because you may win the autographed card of a guy who hasn't played minor league baseball in nearly 20 years, but he's going to the Hall of Fame. Yes, the assist goes to Mike Schmidt for making the Classic collection a worthy buy, not just then, but now. Mike Schmidt is featured on the first card of the set. In fact, we pulled that card from one of our packs, showing him in 1971 with the Reading Phillies. And it has a, you know, brief little career perspective on the back of the card here. But you could also get one of 2,100 autographed cards from Mike Schmidt. So much like many other autograph subset cards from the early 1990s that we saw, especially through the Upper Deck Heroes collection, there is still value and reason to purchase some of these Classic cards in the hope that maybe you get a little lucky and you strike one of these autographed Schmitty cards. Because while there were only 2,100 authenticated cards, I don't think there's actually an accurate count as to how many of those are claimed or still, you know, in the unopened wax population. So the Mike Schmidt card helps promote not just the Classic brand, but also minor league cards in general. And then you've got that research that Classic did to pull in some of the best players, and you've got a pretty good combination of future stars and Hall of Famers. Now, in the packs that we opened up, not only did we get the Mike Schmidt card, but we also got Jim Tomei. We also got Pedro Martinez, as well as I like to say, my brother from another mother, Tim Salmon, is in there as well. Some other notable names, Chipper Jones also. You've got Jeff Kemp. And on top of that, Ivan Rodriguez as well. In fact, you've got two Chipper Jones cards in that set. So you've got some surefire Hall of Famers that are in the set here. And of course, you didn't know that these guys were going to be Hall of Famers back in 1991, but clearly you thought of all the other players at the AA and AAA level. These guys had a good chance to have a productive major league career, and they certainly did. Now, you also have a couple of players who didn't quite have productive major league careers. And one of them was the Chase card of 1991. You know him as well as I do because we kicked aside a lot of other cards in our collections to make sure that his card was in the lockdown case. Yes, I'm talking about the legendary TVP, Todd Van Poppel, card number 386 in the set. Yep, you could have had Chipper Jones, you could have had Jim Tomei, you could have had Ivan Rodriguez, you could have had Pedro Martinez, but you were locking down that damn Todd Van Poppel card. So much like kids were once upon a time pushing aside those Sandberg, Gwynn, and Boggs cards for the Ron Kittles, Todd Van Poppel, very much the poster child of putting your eggs way, way, way too much in the rookie prospect basket. Another notable name, not necessarily because of his baseball career, but because he had a pretty darn good college football career after his minor league time was up. Of course, Chris Winkie, who was in the Blue Jays organization and then went back to college. He would quarterback Florida State for a couple of years and in a very productive time of Florida State football, which certainly is not the situation now. So Classic Best did their homework. They found the top prospects. They found the guys that were slam dunk, gonna be good baseball players, and slam dunk, as it turns out, Hall of Famers. But you also have your notable misses as well in terms of Chris Winkie and Todd Van Poppel. And yeah, you've got your other fringe ball players, some guys who, you know, did play for a few years in Major League Baseball. And then more often than not, some guys that never even got a sniff. So that's always the risk and reward of minor league baseball cards. Not all that different from the risk and reward of Bowman baseball cards. We've talked about, you know, Bowman's propensity for basically being, you know, the card of the future star. You know, they're not minor league cards, but, you know, they're focusing a lot on minor league prospects. Yes, you could get that proverbial 52 mantle out of some of these sets, but more often than not, you're going to get the guy who just never even makes it to the major leagues. So that's the risk and reward. But when it comes to 91 classic minor league cards, the risk is high, the reward is high, because as it turns out, there are still plenty of boxes and sets of these cards out there, and they're pretty affordable too. That's kind of the upside and the downside of the production of any baseball card in 1991, isn't it? The downside is there were just so many of those damn things printed. You know, the saturation, it was just dominant in the hobby back then, and you still feel the effects these days. You know, the value of these cards is suppressed. But at the same time, the upside is if you're looking for a fun throwback that's relatively inexpensive, let me tell you, 91 classic minor league cards is a very good option. I've seen some boxes going for as low as $20 a box. Once you factor in shipping and handling, depending on who's selling it and how, you're looking at a grand total of maybe $35 a box. And that also allows me some comfort, because as I'm opening these packs and I'm pulling Pedro and Tomei, and, you know, looking at all these cards going, wow, look at this card, look at that card. And I'm kind of, you know, cringing a little bit because these cards are not PSA 10. You know, they are 30 years old. Maybe they've been manhandled. In the video that we posted on YouTube, by the way, Wax Ecstatic, 1991 Classic Best Minor League Break, I mentioned that one of my kids' cats, because of the plastic wrapping on these packages, occasionally the cat would get up on the bookshelf that I had these on and would knock them down because, you know, the plastic wrap makes that crinkly sound that cats just cannot avoid. And because of that, perhaps that damaged some cards. I don't know. So I'm cringing at the condition of some of these cards going, oh man, if only this one was in better shape. But then I went, well, hey, Matt, these are so cheap. You might as well just buy a box and open them up, because chances are you're going to get some of these players once again. Now, again, the value of some of these cards are not as high as you would imagine they would be. You would think a minor league Pedro Martinez card would be worth a fortune. Not really. I've seen some PSA 10s putting it at about $100 a piece. Hey, for a minor league baseball card, that's good. But, you know, this is not 52 mantle territory or anywhere close to it. So kind of keep that in mind. But if you're looking for the fun of it, this is definitely a good, fun option. And if you watch the video, you see me getting excited. You know, I'm pulling these cards. I go, hey, Jim Tomei. Wow, here's Pedro Martinez. Oh, hey, I remember this guy. I remember that guy. And, you know, hey, did this guy ever make it to the major leagues? It's a really fun open there. So even though you're not going to get a lot of return on investment in terms of dollars and cents, even if you're able to venture into some of the late 80s pro card sets that are out there, if you get a Frank Thomas, it's worth a few bucks. Go ahead and lock that one down. But even though you're not going to get much of that nowadays, it's still a very fun purchase. And I do suggest, if you're just looking for something fun, you get to look back at some fun baseball names, some fun baseball team names, then if it's 91 classic minor leagues or any of the minor league sets from the late 80s and early 90s, if you can get them for a pretty good price, they are a pretty fun thing to open up and perhaps even a fun thing to collect. If you're able to buy a couple of boxes of the classic cards, you might be able to put together an entire set. At least the low number set. And never anything wrong with that if you're able to put together a set all by yourself and do it for a reasonable price. Now, minor league cards, I don't buy them today for one because I'm just not one that goes chasing for rookie cards. Again, that's not my thing anymore. For a lot of collectors, it is. You're buying the new cards because you want the new players, and I totally get that. But the minor league cards have kind of swung again in the direction that all baseball cards are under, and that, of course, is everything is under the Topps umbrella. So not only do you have the Bowman cards, which, of course, have featured prospects for a couple of decades now, but you also have the Topps Heritage minor league cards. And as much as I love Topps Heritage, I've never really cared for the Topps Heritage minor league cards. And I think it's because the way that minor league cards are handled now, certainly from the Topps Heritage standpoint, it's mostly after the fact. Like, you already know who some of these young stars are. And, you know, it almost seems like just a quick little grab for the minor league fan. I'm not a big proponent of that. Where the minor league cards of the 70s, 80s, and 90s had a little more of a predictive feel to it, for lack of a better term. You know, they're hoping that these guys turn into big players. It almost seems like some of the players that you get now in some of those minor league sets are predestined to make it to the major leagues. Whether they're stars or not is another issue. And there's just something lacking in it. Maybe I just haven't invested enough time or money in it. Maybe I need to kind of experience that. But just, I haven't been drawn to the minor league cards of today. Now, it should also be noted, too, that minor league baseball is going to be changing a lot. I'm sure you're well aware of the fight, the all-out fight that Major League Baseball has had with minor league baseball over the last year. And eventually they will contract the minor leagues. You're not going to have 170 teams. You're going to have 120. And unfortunately, that means that some of those small town teams that we were talking about, and I mean small town teams, they're no longer going to be part of the chain. Now, they may still be part of minor league baseball in the sense of they may be, you know, part of an academy division, if you will. But you're not going to see a lot of these small, especially Midwest towns or small southern towns being part of, say, a double A or triple A level team. Or a league, I should say. So that's unfortunate. You lose part of the old school minor league feel. I think there's also concern that you're going to lose a lot of the minor league creativity. And minor league baseball has a lot of creativity, especially on the promotions and marketing side, because you don't necessarily have the star power. If you're a minor league team that does have a star player, you're not going to have him for long, because if he's a star player, he's going to the major league soon. So, you know, you always have to market around unique giveaways. You've got to market around affordability, family fun, that type of stuff. You know, post-game concerts and fireworks and things like that. You don't really have the player, liquidity that you would with a major league team. You know, the Tampa Tarpons don't have the luxury of saying, hey, we're the New York Yankees. No, you're a Yankees farm club, and sure, maybe I'll see one of your stars down here on a rehab game or two. But in reality, you're a collection of 20, 21-year-old kids who are trying to climb the ladder. So unfortunately, yes, I do agree that I think minor league baseball is going to lose a lot of its creativity, or at least the type of creativity we're aware of. I think you're going to see a lot more vertical integration with major league partners. And really what the fight between Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball is it partially about facilities? Yeah. Is it partially about safety and health? Yeah. Is it partially about trying to make inefficient operations efficient? Yeah. But really what it's all about, folks, it's control. Yeah, money's a big factor, but it's control. And you're going to see, I predict when the dust settles here, whether it's with the minor league baseball corporate entities assistance or not, I think what you're going to see is a collection of four minor leagues with 30 teams in each league. Each major league team will have a team at each level. They may be regionally owned and operated. So, for example, the Tampa Bay Rays, they have a AAA affiliate in the Durham Bulls. They have a AA affiliate in the Montgomery Biscuits. And whatever you have at the A level or rookie level probably does not go distance-wise any further than Durham, North Carolina, or Montgomery, Alabama. You're going to have those teams, you know, based in and around, you know, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, you know, somewhere around there. And I think what you're going to see is what has been popularized around the world in terms of having feeder clubs feeding the parent club, and that is by soccer. And you're seeing Major League Soccer do this. You're seeing the United Soccer League do this as well in the States, where you have the pro league up top, but you have different tiers of minor leagues below. So yeah, there is efficiency, there's facility upgrades, there's safety and health concerns, certainly money and cash flow as well. But it's all about control. Right now, Major League Baseball, with the exception of owned and operated minor league teams, really doesn't have a whole lot of control over minor league operations. By realigning this way, Major League Baseball has a ton, if not complete control, over minor league operations. And if you have complete control, that also means you have complete control of player salaries, of facilities, of merchandise, of broadcast contracts, of concessions and parking, and you name it. And it's all about the almighty dollar. Yep, yep, money always comes back into it, doesn't it, friends? It does. So it's a power grab. It's a money grab. I'm not going to say it's all going to be bad. I do think some good things are going to come out of this. But mark my word, what you are seeing in Major League Baseball now, I think in 10 years, is going to be the norm across all North American sports. All. Like I said, you've seen it in soccer. You've seen a little taste of it with the G League and the NBA. I think you're going to see the NHL. I think you're going to see the NFL eventually come up with some kind of system, especially with more college players demanding rights and payments. Well, that's going to break the old college system. So mark my words, I really think in 10 years, you're going to see the whole minor league / semi-pro world turned upside down, to where instead of some independence and relationships with major leagues and major league clubs, they are going to be all under the major league umbrella. Again, not all bad, but the way that we see and think about minor league sports today, which has been relatively unchanged since the 1960s, I'd say, certainly post-war, it's going to be different. It's going to be very different. And some people don't like different. I do think that there will be some creativity and some opportunities that come out of this, but it's going to be different. Speaking of different, when you're looking at minor league baseball cards, you have to take a little bit of a different approach to the story time portion of the podcast, because, yeah, I could go through here and go, all right, let's tell you about Pedro Martinez and Jim Thomae and Tim Salmon. But that's too easy. You know those guys. And on top of that, we've actually already done biographies of all three of those guys. Go back to our original Monster Box episodes You'll see stories about those guys from the early 1990s. So rather, I went through the packs that we had, and I picked out a few names of players who probably ring a bell, certainly don't have the Jim Thome or Pedro Martinez resume, but at least had either productive major league careers or stood out in some form or fashion. And one of those players turned out to be the last card that I pulled from these packs, and I shared a little bit of his story on the video, and that is Sterling Hitchcock. Now, Sterling Hitchcock is not a good friend of mine, but near and dear to me because we both went to the same high school. And for quite a while, Sterling Hitchcock was the biggest star in terms of athletics from my high school, although that would certainly change over time. And let's talk a little bit about Sterling Hitchcock. Born in 1971 in Fayetteville, North Carolina, but grew up in beautiful Safner, Florida, where I grew up as well, and we both attended Armwood High School. Now, not at the same time. He actually graduated, I believe, 6 years before I did. But Sterling Hitchcock was the biggest athletic star from Armwood High School. Armwood opened up in 1984. He graduated, like I said, I believe in 89. And for a few years, he was in the spotlight because he had made it to the major leagues by 1992. And I was a sophomore in 1992. And I remember how big of a deal it was to have this local baseball player make it to the big leagues. Now, that wasn't a surprise because so many Tampa area kids have made it to the major leagues. But for somebody from tiny Safner, Florida and tiny Armwood High School to do that was pretty big news. Now, Armwood High School, as you may be aware of today, is not known for producing baseball players, although they have, Matt Joyce being another one. But most prominently for football players, when I was at Armwood, the football team rarely won more than four games a season. But by the time I had graduated in 95 and moved on to college, the school took advantage of some realignment to the designated area for students to attend that school. And they were able to pull in some top recruits that way. And they started winning state championships in the late 90s, early 2000s. Quite a few Armwood High School football players have succeeded at the collegiate and the NFL level. But back in the early 1990s, that was not the case. It was baseball, and it was Sterling Hitchcock. He was selected in the ninth round of the 1989 Major League Draft. Even though he was committed to attending the nearby University of South Florida, the Yankees, who had drafted him, offered him a $50,000 signing bonus. And trust me, if you gave me $50,000 to get out of Safner, Florida, I would have done the exact same thing. So he makes his major league debut, very quickly goes up through the system with the Yankees, makes his major league debut in 1992. He is best remembered for making his first start against the Kansas City Royals, also late in the 1992 season, plunking George Brett, which was quite the feat considering Brett was in the process of marching his way to 3,000 career hits, and a pretty bold move there by Sterling Hitchcock. Now, he would play for the Yankees from 1992 to 1995 as the team was starting to build up into a championship team, but he unfortunately wouldn't be part of those championship teams. In fact, this is something that would kind of travel with Sterling Hitchcock. He was on some very good teams, but unfortunately was never on a World Series championship team. In fact, he was traded for a key part of some future Yankees championships, Tino Martinez. That's right, another Tampa native. Hitchcock going to Seattle after the 1995 season for Martinez, as well as Jeff Nelson, Russ Davis, and Jim Messier. He would pitch one season with Seattle in 1996, and then the Mariners would move him to San Diego for Scott Sanders. Now, Hitchcock would become a star pitcher with the Padres, a key part of the Padres winning the National League Championship Series in 1998. In fact, he was named the NLCS MVP as he won both of his starts, had an earned run average of 0.90. In fact, went 3-0 in the 98 playoffs, including the World Series, 1.23 earned run average, 32 strikeouts. So certainly wasn't his fault that the Padres got swept by the Yankees. The Yankees in 1998 were just such an incredible force. Hey, he certainly did his part. Now, he would remain with the Padres through 2001, eventually getting traded back to the Yankees for two minor leaguers. Unfortunately for Hitchcock at this time, dealing with some numerous arm injuries. In fact, he underwent Tommy John surgery during his time in San Diego. Recovers from that, goes to the Yankees, participates in the 2001 World Series. In fact, won Game 5 of the 01 series. But again, the Arizona Diamondbacks winning the World Series that year. He re-signs with the Yankees after the 2001 season. And is part of the Yankee team that was heading towards the World Series in 2003, but the Yankees decided to send him to St. Louis in exchange for Justin Pope and Ben Giuliano, and he would go back to San Diego in 2004. Now, I found some pretty interesting stuff about Sterling Hitchcock from a very unlikely source. I found this magazine. I mean, I didn't find the actual magazine. I found an article from this magazine from Fine Magazine. I have no idea what Fine Magazine is. It looks like a kind of an arts and leisure magazine. But like I said, I found some very interesting stories that were told in this story about Sterling Hitchcock. And it goes back to his high school days. What's interesting is that even though he played baseball in Little League and loved playing baseball, he never really imagined that he would play baseball in high school or any further. And it's because he was kind of smallish in stature. And when you're around these bigger, more muscular kids, you're thinking, well, you have no chance at playing in baseball. So he actually starts a weight training regimen, not to improve in baseball, but in his words, to impress girls. You know, he's trying to, you know, start dating girls. So he's trying to bulk up a little bit. So he starts this weight training regimen. Well, not only does it, I guess, get him some more dates, but also it helps him with his game. So suddenly he's pitching faster. He's throwing harder. He tries out for the team, actually makes it on the varsity team. And as he's doing this weight training, as well as already bringing his, you know, baseball talents to the diamond, it all starts coming together in high school. He is a standout at the local Tony Saladino baseball tournament, and that's where he got the attention of not only USF, but also the New York Yankees. Now, in this article from Fine Magazine, and I never saw a date on this article, amazingly. I'm assuming it's still relatively recent. But after his major league career, Sterling Hitchcock would retire to nearby Naples, which is south of the Tampa Bay area. And he has been doing a lot of golf, but also teaching strength training at a company called Beyond Motion. So he trains a lot of young athletes in, you know, trying to prevent injuries and put themselves in the best shape. So good to hear from Sterling Hitchcock. Again, one of those players that, you know, you recognize, somebody that had a very lengthy and for the most part productive career in Major League Baseball. Didn't get a World Series, you know, had some struggles along the way, but certainly had some bright spots. First of all, being able to put on those pinstripes not once but twice, but also being able to, you know, be a star in your hometown, being able to win a National League Championship Series MVP award, and to also to participate in a couple of World Series. And think of some of the players that he played alongside with, too. You know, first with the Yankees, you've got up-and-coming guys like Jeter and Bernie Williams and Paul O'Neill and you know, Posada and Rivera. I mean, all those guys that were coming up, you know, when he was there. But then, you know, with the Padres in the late 90s, you know, think of Tony Gwynn, think of Gary Sheffield. And then again, you're coming back to the Yankees later on, Tino Martinez and Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit and all these other guys. Just an incredible, you know, good fortune for him. Now, not so much good fortune for one of the other players that we pulled out of the pack here. And I pulled this player because I was so amused by his card. And that would be Greg Hunter. Now, you're probably going, Greg Hunter? Who is Greg Hunter? Well, the card that we pulled for Greg Hunter features him with the San Bernardino Spirit. That's a minor league team in the Seattle Mariners organization. And Greg Hunter just looks flat out bored with life in this baseball card. He just clearly looks like he wants to be somewhere else. And I joke that nobody shows spirit like the San Bernardino Spirit's Greg Hunter. So I decided, all right, let's do a little research here. Tell me more about Greg Hunter. Well, as you can imagine, Greg Hunter, unfortunately, was not able to make it to the major leagues. He was able to get as far as double A ball. That would be, in his case, in Jacksonville in 1992. And it was a very brief time in Jacksonville. In fact, he played for three teams, mostly spent that season at Advanced A Ball. Was able to get a cup of coffee with the AA Hardware City Rock Cats in 1995. But at the age of 27, playing AA ball, you're pretty much done. Now, the good news, though, for Greg Hunter, even though this utility infielder was not able to make it to the big leagues, he was able to be drafted and part of a minor league organization for his home team, the Seattle Mariners. So very much like Sterling Hitchcock being a star for Armwood High School and, you know, a lot of Yankee fans, of course, in the Tampa area being able to follow him. Well, Greg Hunter, class of 86, from his local high school, Juanita High School, was able to be a star in baseball for his home team, even though he never played for them, part of the organization. And he also came from a pretty athletic family, too. His sister, Molly Hunter, who is a year younger than Greg Hunter, was a women's basketball star throughout the late 1980s as well. So even though Greg Hunter couldn't cut it in major leagues as a player, he was able to, as a scout, after his playing days ended in the mid-1990s, he joined the Mariners scouting group and was actually in the scouts with the Mariners for a very long time. In fact, for almost 25 years. Sadly, though, he was one of the many cuts that the Mariners implemented back in the early summer of this year due to the coronavirus because of all the lost revenues. Some teams were making cuts left and right, and Greg Hunter, unfortunately, was one of them. So hopefully, you know, we like to have stories with happy endings. For Greg Hunter's sake, we hope that it has a happy ending because it would be nice to see a guy like Greg Hunter, who didn't make it to the major leagues, but was part of the organization from his hometown, not just as a player, but as a scout for many, many years. Hopefully he'll be able to get back on his feet. Now, speaking of happy endings and getting back on your feet here, I have to share the story of another one of these cards that we pulled here, Gary Caraballo. Now, I picked Gary Caraballo because as I mused, as we're opening up the cards on the video, I thought this would have been a great name for Harry Carey. Could you imagine if Gary Caraballo made it to Major League Baseball? Oh, Harry would have had a field day. Now coming to the plate for the Kansas City Royals, the right fielder, Gary Caraballo. Of course, with Harry Carey's birth name being Harry Carabina, I mean, I could just imagine the Carabina-Caraballo conversation that would have gone on here. Now, unfortunately, for Gary Caraballo, the native of, where was he from? Puerto Rico. There we go. The native of Puerto Rico. I lost my notes here. The native of Puerto Rico and 12th round selection of the Royals in 1989 also never made it to the major leagues. Boy, did he get close, though. A few appearances in Double A, namely with the Memphis Chicks in 1994, also the Hardware City Rock Cats in 1996. Also played for Monterrey in the Mexican League in 1995. Got very, very, very close, but he had an incredible bad stroke of luck. not only could he just not crack past Triple-A or the Mexican League to get into the major leagues. In fact, he kind of went up and down over the last final years, finally ending his playing days in 1995. But in 2004, due to an eye condition, he lost sight in both of his eyes. Unbelievable. He lost sight in both of his eyes, and you would think that all is doomed from this point on. And he was just grief-stricken, not only because this is a terrible thing to happen to an adult. You know, in 2004, Caraballo would have been, 34, 35 years old. So you're in your mid-30s. You're supposed to be your most productive here. Well, he's, of course, devastated because he's afraid that he is not able to see his daughters grow up. So this is a personal devastation for him. Thankfully, for Caraballo, Major League Baseball's BAT program, that is BAT, basically a retirement program to help former ball players get assistance with medical, financial, other issues, they were able to step up. They were able to find a surgeon who was able to correct this degenerative disease in his eyes and bring back his eyesight. So that is the BAT team, that's called the Baseball Assistance Team. He was able to get treatment. His eyesight comes back, and he is just an outstanding story for what Baseball Assistant Team does. So this is just an awesome story of how Gary Caraballo, again, not a bad or late draft pick. You know, 12th round is certainly not, a late pick. And the Kansas City Royals thought he'd be good enough for kind of a utility role infield, outfield. Even though he couldn't progress past Double-A or the Mexican League, he was able to progress in life after what could have been just this awful, awful disease that would have cost his sight. But thankfully for the Baseball Assistant Team, assistance team, he was able to regain his sight, able to watch his family grow up, and at last check, still doing well today. So definitely a happy story there. Last but not least, we pulled the card for Damon Buford. And Damon Buford, again, is just one of those players who you recognize the name. You may not necessarily recognize what he did as a player, or maybe you're wondering, well, what is he doing nowadays? Well, we're able to provide that to you. Damon Buford, first of all, the son of legendary Baltimore Oriole Don Buford. You may not have known that. Yep, Don Buford, who not only played for Baltimore, but also the Chicago White Sox early on in his career, and also spent a few years in Japan. He was one of the many inspirations for Tom Selleck's character, Mr. Baseball. But Don Buford, who is a member of the Baltimore Orioles Hall of Fame, and part of their very successful teams in the late 60s and early 70s. Well, his son Damon, who was born in 1970, not surprisingly in Baltimore, Maryland, he lucks out as he is able to be part of the Orioles organization after playing at the University of Southern California, much like his dad did. And he had some pretty good teammates, too, at USC. Brett Boone, Jeff Cirillo, Brett Barbary, or as Harry would call him, Brett Barbecue. Well, he gets signed by the Baltimore Orioles. And he was able to play with the Orioles from 1993 to 95. Later gets traded to the New York Mets and then plays a couple seasons with the Rangers, couple seasons with the Red Sox, couple seasons with the Chicago Cubs before hanging it up. Let me pull up the transaction log for Damon Buford real quickly here. I want to see if he was traded for anybody notable. No, it doesn't look like it here. Drafted in the 10th round by Baltimore in 1990, traded with Alex Ochoa. Yes, there was a notable name here for Bobby Bonilla. Of course, the Mets still paying the tab on that guy. Traded Mets to the Rangers for Terrell Lowry. Rangers with Jim Leyritz to Boston for Mark Brandenburg, Bill Hazeman, and Aaron Seeley. Traded Red Sox to the Cubs for Manny Alexander. No, other than Bobby Bonilla, that's pretty much it. So, you know, you kind of look at the Damon Buford story there and you go, okay, well, that's that's pretty much it. And yeah, you know, nothing, you know, incredible about his career. Certainly a very serviceable, very dependable center fielder for many years. Managed to play, let's see, how many seasons was it? 12 seasons or 11 seasons, excuse me. Like I said, with several teams here, career batting average 242, 54 home runs, 218 RBI. So good, but not great. Certainly better than a lot of the other players that you find in these pack of minor league cards. So you're probably wondering, well, Matt, whatever happened to Damon Buford? Well, I'll tell you. After he retired in the early 2000s, Damon got into coaching, but he also got into the business side of things. And you see this with a lot of former ball players. Somebody comes up with a product or a service and they invest in it. Sometimes they sell it too. I can speak, Rob Ducey is selling artificial turf, you know, to youth leagues and parks and recs departments and you know, minor league teams. Well, the business that Damon Buford is involved in is called UFloat. That's the letter U, Float, which is basically kind of like a life preserver pair of shorts. That's the best way I can describe it. I was doing a little bit of research on what UFloat is, and it is a personal flotation device. PFD is what us campers and wilderness people call it. And most personal flotation devices are life vests. So something that you put over your head and shoulders, you strap around your chest and your stomach, and you go bobbing around, in a lake or, pool or whatever with your personal flotation device. Well, rather than having the vest, you could have a UFloat, which is almost like a floating pair of Depends. I hate to say it that way, but that's the way it looks. It's kind of like a harness, a floating harness. So, this is for people who would rather, instead of bobbing up and down, up around the neck and shoulders, you basically sit in this thing and secure it to your body. And, it pulls you down just a little bit to where, you're almost like sitting in a chair as opposed to having the weight up top. And of course, it's a thing for good looks as well. If you're somebody who doesn't like the dreaded tan lines of a life vest, well, the UFloat will take care of that for you, because obviously it's pulling the lower half of you down below the water. So if you're somebody who likes to float in water and also get a complete suntan, then you don't need to worry about the life vest getting in the way of that. So it looks like a unique and certainly legit product there. But if you had on your bingo card former Major League ball player Damon Buford, son of legendary Baltimore Oriole Don Buford, selling personal flotation devices that you sit in, congratulations, collect your winnings at window number 5. So that's a look at the minor league players that we pulled there. A couple who did make it to the majors, Damon Buford and Sterling Hitchcock. And then a couple who didn't, but certainly you still have some pretty good stories of them. And it's always, a reminder that even the common player, even in the minor league stacks, doesn't always have the minor story. Certainly Greg Hunter, who didn't play in the bigs, but was able to be part of his hometown baseball team for many years in terms of being a minor league player or in scouting and management, or the very inspirational story of Gary Caraballo, who also didn't make it to the majors, but also almost went through life, the latter years of his life being blind, but thankfully through the baseball assistance team, able to get that degenerative disease corrected and to where he can actually see his family, see his kids, and actually live life to its fullest. So that's definitely a fun thing to hear. And what's also definitely fun is the minor league cards, really of the late 80s and early 90s. Again, you're not going to get a huge return on investment, but minor league cards are still fun to dive into. Me personally, I prefer the ones from the past, but perhaps you would like to invest some time and money in the current minor league cards. And specifically the ones from about 30 years ago, they're still fun because they are mostly affordable. You do still have some chase cards, and some of the names that you pull, you get a Pedro, you get a Tome, you get some, like I said, a Frank Thomas or a Moises Alou, you get some of these other star players from the 1990s in their pre-major league days. It's still pretty exciting to pull that card and go, wow, I got this guy. And it's not quite the same as it was 30 years ago, because those cards were worth a little more back then. But it's still a pretty fun thing to partake in. So if you have the chance to do it, by all means, do it. It's definitely fun for you. Speaking of fun, we've got a couple of fun products in our next podcast that will be coming your way 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, October 23rd. We're going to be looking at 87 Donruss All-Star Pop-Ups and the All-Star Gum Wrappers from 1979 Topps Chewing Gum. If you would like to contribute to the program, please do at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Any cash donation is greatly appreciated. If you don't want to make a cash donation, you want to make a cardboard donation, we've gotten quite a few of those recently, email me, mattsammonsays, that's S-E-Z, @gmail.com. Be happy to talk to you about some cardboard donations that you would like to make. And also, you can always comment about our program or make suggestions on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining me on Wax Ecstatic. Wear your mask, wash your hands, social distance. Let's keep it going. Let's keep beating this coronavirus. Let's have fewer infections than the White House. I know I'm setting the bar very high here, but let's just keep plugging away here so that we can all gather again for the next edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you then.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.